we have to protect them. So visit, discover their beauty, and do what you can to safeguard them from misuse, vandalism, and looting. Visit conservationlands.org.
My fellow Americans, a crisis is approaching. For nearly a decade, radio stations have been contaminated, polluting the airwaves. The word has come back from across the nation. U.S. citizens do not want to hear that dookie on the radio anymore. It is the music of tyranny. But I have a plan for change, and that plan is the hip-hop lock with Snake Peters. I got the affidavit and the legislation prior to this meeting that Snake Peters was throwing it down on the hip-hop lock. Every Friday from 10 to 12 on KWVA UG. Our goal is focused, our cause is just, and our coalition is strong. The hip-hop block with Snake Peters. Every Friday from 10 to 12 on KWVA UG. We rock out.
Man, I got a problem.
Oh yeah, what's that?
Well, you see, I'm going up to Portland for the weekend, and I'm kind of, like, addicted to KWVA radio, and I just don't know what I'm going to do without it for the weekend. Like, it sucks.
Don't you know, KWVA is offered over the Internet at www.kwvaradio.org.
You mean I can go to my parents' house, turn the computer on, get online, and listen to KWVA?
Oh, yeah.
That's fantastic. Thanks for the information, knowledge guy.
You're very welcome. KWVA Radio. Available over the internet at www.kwvaradio.org.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily the views of KWVA Radio or the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. Anarchy Radio is an editorial collage providing analysis and opinions of John Zerzan and the community at large.
All right, it's Anarchy Radio tonight on KWVA Eugene. We're getting all the technical aspects of this sorted out, but we'll be back in just a minute. It's just me and John in the studio tonight, 541-346-0645, or you can instant message us at kwvaradio.org. Here's the Lesser Beggars to start us off.
The whole world's on fire. We'll be right back.
devil dances inside full pockets. And the devil dances inside full pockets.
Anarchy Radio, April 5. That was the Lesser Beggars. Getting us off to a strong start, apropos the Albuquerque Symposium. I was down there from Thursday to Sunday. And I'll get to that in 1 second. First of all, I keep forgetting to spread this around, but having trouble with Johnsers and at Hotmail, at my end anyway. So if you want to get a hold of me, please use JZ Primitivo at gmail.com. Next week, Philippe Burrell will be here from Paris. He made Eco Warriors for alternative TV. I think most of his film work is in that vein, about an hour in length. The next one will be Humanity 2.0, famous 2.0 or 2.0 motif, and he's working on that. Get to talk to him as of Monday, and he's going to come down to the studio. So we'll see what kind of format that'll be. I'd like to ask him about his work. All right, 541-346-0645. And I did have a dandy weekend down there. This was Friday and Saturday, mostly at the University of New Mexico campus. And I'm going to close the door because I hear 7 seconds in the past. Oh, thanks, Carl. Yeah, this was the main deal was a panel with Layla Abdelrahim, Ched Myers, and myself. And there were prepared questions and a lot of discussion. About 100 people, both total. Albuquerque is not really a big hotbed of anarcho-primitivism, but this was once again largely a dialogue between anarcho-primitivism and the general secular sense and Christian primitivists. And I was pretty impressed with Ched, Mennonite guy. I thought we might really have some fireworks, but it was fruitful. I think people there seemed quite engaged, and the questions were real good. And it's always great to see my friend Layla. She was down from Montreal. Andy Lewis, he helped out. And this was primarily put together, and so very well put together, by Liza and Derek with the help of Andy. Yeah, it was quite nicely organized, but not over-organized. So it was, I think it was a real good feel. There was, there was focus in the sense of a few pages of prepared questions. We didn't get to all those, but that kind of opened it up to the general dialogue with the people that were there. So, Layla, from her work, she's written her dissertation in Montreal, which is going to be a book. I think that was the game involved. She was able to write a book under the guise of doing a PhD dissertation. Ched Myers has written a lot of stuff, and by the way, it's Chedmyres, and I think you could get a hold of his stuff pretty easily. I think you can find that pretty well. Very strong stuff. Not afraid at all of property damage. You really had to answer that one, and didn't blink about that. He's made that pretty clear. And you know, another thing that was really cool about this thing, this was not funded by the university at all. They gave us the space. They gave us the use of a couple of rooms, a couple of spaces, but they raised money just on a real grassroots basis, and I think they needed about $1,600. Yeah, a lot of people coughed up, and that helped the whole tenor of it, I think. So, if you have any questions about that or any other thing, 541-346-0645. Yeah, Albuquerque is quite a place. We were in the part that's called the South Valley or the jungle, and across the Rio Grande, not on your upscale university side. But, it was neat to walk around there. They get 8 inches of rain annually. 8 inches? What do we get? 48? I think it's something like that here. The averages in Western Oregon here. Yeah. Okay. Well, close to a year ago now, it was the onset, the beginning of the millions of barrels of oil that started gushing into the Gulf. And now, of course, millions of gallons of highly radioactive water are gushing into the Pacific from your Fukushima nuclear complex. Must have energy, must have energy. Boy, I noticed this is from Friday. This came out Friday. There's a piece was called New Urgency and Push for Radiation Drugs. Radiation drugs. Yeah, there'll be a pill for that. You know, that's the answer. Drugs are always the answer. Drug technology. Wow. All right. Well, fortunately, there's another kind of energy that's still showing itself in North Africa and in the Middle East, from Syria up north all the way down to Yemen. We'll see. That is continuing to play out, of course. And let's see what else this week. Oh, opening day of Major League Baseball. And after the opener at Dodger Stadium in L.A., they played the San Francisco Giants. A San Francisco Giants fan was beaten nearly to death. I don't know if he's in critical condition still or if he's dead after the game. Yeah, the good old sports thing of mass society as mass society continues to decompose. I'd like to remind, not that we don't need too much reminding, I don't think we need too much, but 10 coal miners killed in a gas explosion inside a coal mine in China, a frequent cause of death, of course, in the mines. Oh, I wish, yeah, I think we're going to start having videotape versions of this show. I think there's going to be an intern from Lane Community College, although I answered the thing. I sent a phone message to see if somebody was coming tonight. I would have shaved and combed my hair, maybe, but there's nobody here. Anyway, if that was going on, I could show what I'm showing Carl right now. This radical sustainability, by the way, was one theme of the symposium down in Albuquerque this weekend. This is all about, there's a lot been written about China as a big innovator. They're taking over the market for green technology, all these alternative energy things. This is about wind power from the Daily Mail last week. It's got some incredible pictures. In order to make the wind turbines, you need some of these what are called rare earth. They're not necessarily rare, but there's usually a lot involved in processing them. And this is the same kind of thing, for example, neodymium, which is what is needed in this case specifically for the magnets in the wind turbines. This is so toxic. There's a picture of a lake here, a 5-mile-long lake that is incredibly poisoned. You wretch from the fumes of this highly polluted thing. They've 7 million tons a year of mined rare earths goes into the mix here. After it's been doused in acid and other horribly toxic chemicals and processed through furnaces, and then they dump it in this lake. And this is one of the most polluted cities in China. It's just this bubbling poison waste. And that's, but you look at the, don't look at that. Look over here at the nice gleaming wind farm. It's so clean. It's so cool. And this is much worse than coal. Okay, it's just a gigantic toxic lake. Of course, the air is toxic. Yeah, and that really jumped out as an amazing example. In fact, this week, we saw this Saturday morning, the new issue of Newsweek, this week's Newsweek. The cover, you might have seen it, Apocalypse Now, and it's got this enormous wave. Of course, it's about Japan, but all kinds of stuff. It's like almost once again and this is not in-depth primitivist theory here, but part of the one of the subplots or sub-stories in the issue, in the featured thing, perilous civilizations. Yeah, and on the brink of catastrophe. I would say that maybe this is once again the Newsweek mass media thing is trumping the left. And they're not worried. I've never heard Noam Chomsky say anything about the apocalypse. He's just, let's just keep industrializing. We have 7 billion people after all. Have you heard that? We got 7 billion people, or almost. Got to keep going. All right. Oh, here's a good one. Obama got an openness award for transparency in government. Openness. I think it was Thursday. It was presented in closed session.
No way.
Really? No media were allowed. That's great. Yeah, in Washington, I guess.
Do they not understand irony?
I guess they're just beyond the reach of that, I guess. It's just, yeah. The openness award behind closed doors. I like it. And, of course, he's continuing the no trials, no regular trials for alleged terrorists, the alleged 9/11 attackers. They're going to have the military tribunal stuff. They're not going to have a trial with any kind of show of due process or anything like that. Weather. Ooh. It wasn't really in Colorado or Texas, but they had all these wildfires over the weekend. And I think this was Saturday. The temperature in Denver was 84 for the date, which I think was Saturday, record by 8 degrees. And then coming back Sunday, there was a snowstorm. I know, because I had to sleep on the floor at the Denver airport. I couldn't get out. I couldn't get the connecting flight to Eugene.
At least it's a comfortable airport.
Yeah, it wasn't snowing inside. I mean, why complain? And today, there were 1,100 storms in the U.S. in the past 24 hours, as of this morning, I think. 8 dead in the American South. And what was the other weather thing? Thailand. They've had... Oh, where is it? No, it's a good thing we're not on camera, because this is just such a confusing pile of stuff. Anyway, they've had unprecedented weather there. Of course, in Denver, when it snowed, that shows the right-wing morons that there is no global warming, you know, and that's not happening. Even though the day before was a record. Yeah, a little more on that, by the way. This came out just today, that there's a very good chance that a huge Arctic pool of mostly fresh water could flush into the Atlantic, could suddenly drop down into the North Atlantic and greatly alter the weather, because the amount of fresh water from the melting glaciers, from the rivers in Canada and Siberia, for example, is much greater. Well, again, due to the ice melting. This has never been observed before to this degree, not even close. That'll change the salinity level and change the circulation of the ocean and all these things. They're just kind of these weird dominoes. Well, this China piece just blew me away. In fact, I used it in my remarks in New Mexico. And mountain glaciers, according to a bunch of professors from a Welsh university, a team led by Professor Neil Glasser, mountain glaciers are melting up to 100 times faster than at any time in the past 350 years. Glaciers of Patagonia in South America, for example. Let's see, what happened? Well, we were getting ready for the Industrial Revolution, I guess. I think I may read my latest thing called Happiness in the second half of the show. So if you want to call, maybe you should call now, because I might use up a big chunk of that. We'll see. We'll see what happens. Action news. Let's get into action news. Got some crazy techno news. We'll probably get to that as well. Well, 10 days ago, this was in Ably, in the region of Paris, a the large semi-truck and trailer were burned. This is a good example of ALF militancy and courage. This is, it's about slaughterhouse connections here. Act now and save lives. Sabotages, fires, or liberation. We have to fight by whatever means for all the animals which suffer. This is a classic ALF thing. Last Wednesday, a parcel bomb exploded in the offices of the Swiss nuclear lobby in the town of Olten in Switzerland. Two employees had superficial burns. Switzerland is debating nuclear power stations, and this place is the also the headquarters of Alpiq in Switzerland, this town of Olten. And there have been demonstrations there, anti-nuke demonstrations before. Last Thursday night, one building in Montreal, windows smashed, paint thrown against the walls. Two security companies, because they maintain the society of domination, also the surveillance cameras of the security companies were wrecked. Last Thursday night, also in Asheville, American Apparel was blitzed, windows and so forth. Oh, no, it was in Seattle in solidarity with the Asheville 11 of Asheville, North Carolina. Solidarity. Friday night, lots of anarchist spray painting in Lincoln, Nebraska. That's not such a big deal, but Lincoln, Nebraska, I hadn't heard from them. I haven't heard from Nebraska too much. Three banks in Olympia Friday night. Locks and ATMs glued shut. Black paint applied liberally on the buildings. And also Friday night at Chase Bank in Seattle. Windows broken. Black paint delivered. More solidarity. And yesterday, Monday the 4th, another Central Bank of Asia was attacked, mainly the ATM machines in Indonesia. I think it was just last week there was another one of these. The industrial development of Kulon Progo is at issue. There are many people who don't want that to happen, apparently, and in solidarity with indigenous people there. Tar sands campaign in various places, and I saw photos here, and it looks like an alliance between tribal folks and activists, non-tribal activists, in various places, including Oregon now. And this is a long-running deal in South Dakota, the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. I think this started maybe 3 weeks ago. There was a protest and a sit-in over the abuse of a senior indigenous folks on the res, the Porcupine community, abused by the tribal government, so often the case, different kinds of corruption and strong-arm tactics. I was reminded of a remark by Ward Churchill, by the way, in Arizona a few months ago. He said, it's okay to hate Indians. And after the sort of gasping, I think he said he meant these tribal people that are just an extension of the federal government. And really always have been. Anyway, elders and others have been trying to force a stop to the ripoffs and the kind of goon squad treatment at the hands of these people in charge in Porcupine community. This from Strongheart Warrior Society and traditional elders. I don't know the status of this right now, but actually it's been going on throughout March. Maybe if somebody does, please let us know. And let's see, one other thing, Christian Williams, who is a great resource, sorry to objectify you, Christian, but he's written Our Enemies in Blue. That's a key text in terms of police, the role of the police. He'll be speaking up in Portland, Oregon, next weekend at the Counterinsurgency Convergence at Reed College. That's April 8th to the 10th. And the following weekend, April 15th to 17th, Christian Williams will be speaking at the Law and Disorder Conference at Portland State, across the river from Reed. Okay. Here's a synthetic clouds for Qatar. They are hosting the World Cup, the World Football or Soccer Championships, in 2022. They've got a big program on to develop synthetic clouds because it gets pretty warm there. And you're sitting there in the stadium watching soccer or football. This is some kind of synthetic carbon fiber and helium. And I'm going to just have these nice clouds up there so people can sit in the shade. Yeah, it's all part of the good stuff. Would that be part of the can't possibly go wrong category?
It's got to be. It's a contender.
Already. And they've only started to waste money on something like that. Okay. Yeah, we're buzzing along toward the break. I just want to mention one thing. I don't know. I was going to save this for the end, but it just seems so cool. I'm just about at the end of Austerlitz. Austerlitz, the novel by W.G. Sebald. This really struck a chord just a few years ago. Sebald died, I think, a couple of years ago. Big hit about a fellow named Austerlitz who was brought up in Wales, but he was a refugee kid at the beginning, right before the beginning of World War II. And he slowly sort of tries to find out who he really was, what his real name was. He was adopted. Anyway, I can see why a lot of people were impressed. And he finally finds his relatives, or the ones that haven't been killed, in Prague, or near Prague, I think. And he meets up with this old woman who is kind of his aunt, somebody who had a big interest in him and helped out his parents who were dead. And so he goes there and they kind of reminisce, and she says he always wondered when it snowed how the squirrels could find their hoard. And she says here, "Those were your very words, the question which constantly troubled you. How indeed do the squirrels know? What do we know ourselves? How do we remember? And what is it we find in the end?" Anyway, that kind of grabbed me. While I was on the floor at the Denver airport, I was almost done with this. I guess let's take a break now. It's just about 7:30. 541-346-0645.
मेरी कुछ वो हेल सी गई
On this program are not necessarily the views of KWVA Radio or the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. Anarchy Radio is an editorial collage providing analysis and opinions of John Zerzan and the community at large.
And that was Robbie Shergill, a friend of ours. He's going to be a key person in making this third trip to India happen, and it continues to look like it will happen at the end of the year. All right, I'm going to read the latest thing I've written. I don't know how long this will take. It's not very long. It's only about 4 pages. And then we'll move on to other things. I think we'll still have time. It's just called Happiness. Is happiness really possible in a time of ruin? Can we somehow flourish, have complete lives? Is joy any longer compatible with the life of today? A deep sense of well-being has become an endangered species. How often does one hear, "It is good to be here," or Wordsworth's reference to the pleasure which there is in life itself? Much of the prevailing condition and the dilemma it poses is expressed by Adorno's observation, "A wrong life cannot be lived rightly." In this age, happiness, if not obsolete, is a test, an opportunity. To be happy is to be able to become aware of oneself without being frightened, said Walter Benjamin. We seem to be desperate for happiness as bookshelves, counseling rooms, and talk shows promote endless recipes for contentment. But the well-worn feel-good bromides from the likes of Oprah, Eckhart Tolle, and the Dalai Lama seem to work about as well as a happy meal, happy hour, or a Coke's invitation to pour happiness. Gone is the shallow optimism of yesterday. Such as it was, the mandatory gospel of happiness is in tatters. As Elaine C. Chu put it, we are born to the difficulty in taking pleasure from absence. We sense, quote, only a little light in great darkness, to quote Pound, who borrowed from Dante. How do we explore this? What is expected regarding happiness? In light of all that stand in its way or erodes it, is happiness mainly a fortuitous accident? Very often, to be sure, happiness is approached in terms of what it isn't. Walter Kerr's The Decline of Pleasure opens with this: I'm going to start out by assuming that you are approximately as unhappy as I am. We are a society of notoriously unhappy people, according to Eric Fromm. But we are not supposed to go around admitting this bottom line truth about ourselves and society. Various contemporary theorists, by the way, have steadily chipped away at the very notion of the self, redefining it as nothing more than an intersection of shifting discourses. When the self is all but erased, happiness, in quotes, can no longer even be a valid topic. But our yearning for well-being is not so easily written off. Elizabeth Rudinesco provides a plausible judgment. The more individuals are promised happiness and the ideal of security, the more their unhappiness persists. The steeper the risk profile grows, and the more the victims of unkept promises revolt against those who have betrayed them. In this precarious world, happiness and fear are oddly joined. People are afraid. They are afraid, Adorno claimed, that they would lose everything, because the only happiness they know, even in thought, is to be able to hold on to something. This condition contrasts qualitatively with what is known of so many non-domesticated people, their lack of fear, their trust in the world they inhabit. The Himalayan nation of Bhutan attracted much notice in the middle of the first decade of this century for its gross national happiness concept. The decision to measure the quality of its society not by industrial output, gross national product, but in terms of its citizens' happiness. Apparently, however, Bhutan quickly lost the somewhat isolated character of its culture, which had spurred the GNH idea in the first place. Inundated by pop culture, celebrity consciousness, consumer fads, and the rest of a globalized modernity, the emphasis on happiness as a national value has faded. Mass society restricts happiness to the spheres of consumption and distraction to a great degree, yet happiness remains an experience of fullness rather than seriously misguided efforts to fill emptiness. Many studies show that happiness levels fall with increasing accumulation of wealth. In removing ourselves from nature, we become insensible to its wholeness and approach it as another passive object to be consumed. Is there a truth of happiness on whose basis happiness can be judged? Happiness is as encompassing as it is immediate. It has many facets and manifestations. It is elemental, potent. Like health, happiness is contagious and breeds hope in others. Happiness has to do with one's whole reaction to life. And for that reason alone, it is personal as well as mysterious. The philosopher Wittgenstein had a harsh and pessimistic temperament and experienced his share of intense anguish. His seems the portrait of an unhappy man, and yet his biographer Norman Malcolm reports that his last words were, "Tell them I've had a wonderful life." John Keats' brief life is overshadowed by illness, but he often claimed that things are gorgeous because they die. The sources of happiness lie in various spheres of our lives, but characteristically, these are not so separate. Human life has never been lived in isolation, so we seek experiences that are more than just meaningful for ourselves alone. Vivas van Sony's insight says a lot. No part of life can be bracketed as irrelevant to happiness. All of life counts infinitely. There is no greater tragedy than unhappiness, and no greater responsibility for us than happiness. In my experience, the cornerstone of happiness is love. Here is a dimension where we find the greatest fulfillment. Frantz Fanon, better known for his work on other subjects, subscribed to a standard of, quote, authentic love, wishing for others what one postulates for oneself. There are other satisfactions, but do they match the satisfying and enriching quality of love relations? If a child has love and protection, there is the basis for happiness throughout life. If neither is provided, his or her prospects are very limited. If only one of them is to be given, I think that love outranks even protection or security in terms of the odds for happiness. Some have dissented as to the centrality of love. Nietzsche and Sartre seem to have seen love as confining, closing off prerogatives. That bloodless master of cheap irony, E.M. Cioran, provides this little meditation. I think of that emperor dear to my heart, Tiberius, of his acrimony and his ferocity. I love him because his neighbor seemed to him inconceivable. I love him because he loved no one. What would a history of happiness look like? Once happiness was a central focus of thought in the West. Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics, for example, is a major discourse on the subject. Epicurus spent his life facing the question of how to attain happiness, arousing the ire of our modern friend Cioran. The latter referred to Epicurus' writings as a compost heap. citing him as indicative of the false path that occurs, quote, when the problem of happiness supplants that of knowledge. Much later, the Cartesian account of emotions as so many sensations enters the picture, and Voltaire was the last happy writing, according to Roland Barthes. The 18th century saw a deluge of writing about happiness, mainly focused on private well-being. A thorough depoliticizing of what was meant by happiness was taking place on the eve of mass society. Kant typified this trend by bonding, even equating, duty-oriented morality with happiness. The new century exhibited the romantic emphasis on joy rather than happiness. Blake, Wordsworth, for example, with joy's strong connotation of that which is fleeting. Trenchant, indeed, was the hymn to a hopeful future expressed in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, in particular its final movement based on Schiller's Ode to Joy. The work has justly been termed the last serious music expressing happiness or joy. As industrial life began to spread, it can be no coincidence that Hegel saw human history as the record of irredeemable misfortune. Modern wage labor and political social contract theorizing, for example, the U.S. Constitution, legitimated the pursuit of private happiness. In the public sphere, the question of general happiness was downplayed. Reward became the name of the game. For Hegel, property and personality were almost synonymous. Marx associated happiness with the satisfaction of interests alone. Sentimentalism was an important facet of the 19th century cultural ethos, the underlying emotional tableau of lost community. A fragmented, anonymous society had all but abandoned the goal of widespread happiness. The early Victorian utilitarianism of John Stuart Mill, less crude than that of its founder Bentham at least, failed to recognize the impoverishment of the age. Mill was the last philosopher of social happiness. Jean-Francois Lyotard placed the withdrawal of the real at the center of the experience of modernity. We are losing the reference, the real things, felt contact with what is non-simulated. How could happiness not decline in the bargain? It has declined. The technoculture's ascent is the descent of happiness. Today's dreary, isolating technological frenzy keeps sinking it further with various pathological effects, but our quest remains what it was for Spinoza, the search for happiness with the reality of our bodies in a real bodily world. In the 1890s, Anton Chekhov visited Sakhalin Island with its Gilyak hunter-gatherers. He observed that they had not yet come to grips with roads. Often, he noted, you will see them making their way in single file through the marshes beside the road. End of quote. They were always somewhere and were uninterested in being nowhere on industrialism's roadway. They had not yet lost the singularity of the present, which technology exactly takes away. With our dwindling attention spans, foreshortening shallowness of thought, and thirst for diversions, how much are we actually in the world? The disembodied self becomes increasingly disengaged from reality, including emotional reality. Anxiety has replaced happiness as the hallmark sensation, now that community is absent. We no longer trust our instincts. Maintaining a vast distance from the rhythms of nature and primary experiences of the senses in their intimate concreteness, the leading thinkers so often consecrate or uphold this unhappy disembodied state. Alain Badiou, for example, concurs with Kant that truth and overall health are, quote, independent of animality and the whole world of sense. But what is abstract about happiness? Its state are completed each moment, each embodied moment. Each happiness comes for the first time, as Levinas realized. Czeslaw Milos described his happy childhood. I lived without yesterday or tomorrow in the eternal present. That is precisely the definition of happiness, end quote. Postmodern irony and detachment, with their bedrock of embracing the technosphere, constitute one more means of wresting us from the present moment. A most basic human longing is to belong, to experience union with something other than oneself. Bruno Bettelheim described a feeling engendered in his case by great art, quote, of being in tune with the universe, of all needs satisfied. I felt as though I were in touch, in communication with man's past and connected with his future. He associated this with Freud's oceanic feeling, the sensation of an indissoluble bond, of being one with the external world as a whole. I think it possible to see this as a vestigial, as a visceral surviving link to a previous condition. There's a great deal of anthropological, ethnological literature describing indigenous people who live in oneness with the natural world and one another. Survival itself necessitated a borderlessness between inner and outer worlds. Our ultimate survival requires that we recover that oneness. At times we still feel a return to that unified state. Fairly often in psychological counseling, there is a search for a time in childhood when one was healthy and happy. Arguably, to apply the ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny thesis, each of us reenacts a larger history of humanness. T.S. Eliot's designation of our return is, quote, through the unknown remembered gate. Freud counterposed civilization and happiness because civilization, domestication more precisely, is, quote, based on compulsory labor and instinctual renunciation. Having to fight against instincts is the formula for decadence. So long as life is ascending, happiness and instinct are one thing, observed Nietzsche. The internalization and universalization of this renunciation of freedom is what Freud called sublimation. As Norman O'Brown saw it, sublimation presupposes and perpetuates the loss of life and cannot be the mode in which life itself is lived. The very progress of civilization requires an even greater measure of renunciation, an even greater settling ourselves apart from our environment. And yet the oceanic feeling can still be powerfully felt, recalling that earlier state of being. How much fresher, more vivid, and more valued life can feel after a serious illness. This may be the case upon our recovery from the sickness we call civilization. But here we are now, so very far from any original wholeness or fullness. And the horror, in Adorno's judgment, is that for the first time we live in a world in which we can no longer imagine a better one. At present, the only happy context is the imagined one, or at least the happiness achieved in expressing the truth about unhappiness. In Milosh's heartfelt words, it would seem that all living beings should fall into each other's arms, crying out that they cannot live. The aim of life is to live it strongly, to be fully awake. This aim collides with the new malaise of civilization, an end times sense of everything, a post-you-name-it cultural landscape, a sense of helplessness promoted in no small part by the postmodern doctrine of ambiguity and ambivalence. Happiness entails refusal of Foucault's docile bodies condition, insistence on being vivid rather than domesticated, determination to live as barbarians, resisting the unfreedom and numbness of civilization. An instinct tells us that there is something different, however distant it may seem. We know we were born for something better. The reality of deep unhappiness is the reminder of that instinct which lives and struggles to be heard. The story of happiness did not have to unfold as it did. In our own lives, we are so lucky to have a sense of being blessed, to have some gladness, a sense of worth, to have a certain astonishment at being here at all. For ourselves, meaning and happiness are always interwoven. Happiness is grounded in meaningfulness. A life of meaning is the meaning of life. To happiness, the same applies as to truth. One does not have it, but is in it, in Adorno's pithy formulation. He also said philosophy exists in order to redeem what you see in the look of an animal. To meet myself face to face, in Thoreau's words, to realize ourselves in our distinctly human capacities within what is possible, not to blame ourselves for the limits imposed on us, and to find the strength to speak the unsaid. Happiness is not the result of understanding the real depth of our predicament. In fact, its understanding can be liberating, strengthening. It may lead to something that could hardly be more momentous. The quest for directness and immediacy in the real world. The project of confronting the very nature of our domesticated, civilized, technology-ridden unhappiness. Ooh, that took up, took up most of the second half. And now you may call 541-346-0645. I know you were just straining at the phone station. Well, the Oxford English Dictionary, you might have read about this, what has been added, the OMG, LOL. You know,
heart.
Yeah, it's heart, right. Yeah, that's nothing about cheapening communication or... You just have a little symbol or an emoticon.
Emoticon.
Emoticon, I love it, right? Little smiley face. Who needs to know any words or anything? And let's see. Borders is closing, speaking of words, but this is from Linton Weeks. We are not just digging the hole anymore. He or she is meditating on books and how we don't read whole books anymore. And probably everybody fell asleep during my reading. Anyway, no, not the listeners to this show. Anyway, it talks about the specialization in abbreviated material and the whole context of browse and choose consumption, where every little piece of information is, as he says, it shoots through the internet and is Ginsu knifed into smaller bits, so it's part of the division of labor. We don't do any whole things anymore, is his conclusion here. And let's see, what are some of the latest apps? So here's a little piece last week. You can take it with you in an app. And I thought, what's this about? Anyway, this is the, I'm sure quite a few people do that. What it is a program to ease the arduous chore of inputting items. In other words, you can keep track of all your stuff. Home goods can be indexed on many devices. And we got so much junk that you need a computer to keep track of it all. Whoa. So you can carry that. Yeah, how many copies of something do I have? Or how many television sets? Look it up on the computer. Yeah, and then go out and invent a storage space. Because probably some of it is out there, huh? Well, more on cell phone radiation. It does alter how the brain works. And, quite possibly, it causes you-know-what. This is from the Sunday New York Times. Erasing the digital past. This is a big, long article. People who are unhappy with unflattering information and images that pop up when others Google them are increasingly hiring online reputation managers.
Reputation defender.
Yeah, you've heard of this.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have one?
Of course I do.
You must have one. You need one. Yeah, I haven't got one yet. I hope they're not too spendy.
Yeah.
Probably charge a lot.
Yeah, they probably do.
Well, I think I did mention this book by Brian Christie called The Most Human Human. That was really... there was a prize, in case I didn't talk about this one, a prize for machine kind of interaction. And the usual emphasis is the most human computer, according to the Turing test, Alan Turing. Mm-hmm. If you can fool a computer where the answer is just typed out, you wouldn't have to worry about voices, then that's, according to him, that would meet the actual definition of intelligence or being smart. That's really the only, that's all there is to it. I mean, that's the famous Turing test. Turing, who killed himself about 60 years ago. He was a code breaker and came up with some of the basic concepts for computers. He's being prosecuted for being gay, and he smeared some arsenic on an apple and bit into it. And it's always amazed me that Apple has that symbol, you know, the apple with the bite. Of course, it's the garden and everything. It's not necessarily Alan Turing in the picture, but why would that be their logo? You know, that's the whole bad news of getting into all this. Anyway, this book, The Most Human Human, what it really gets down to is that we are becoming more machine-like, and it isn't necessarly so much that the machines are getting, quote, smarter. So we have to try to start identifying human humans, you know, as people start doing everything by the machine, including now the best chess players are playing the computer game. They're not playing chess the way they used to. Got somebody there?
Yeah, this is John from Michigan.
Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good.
Thanks for reading the piece. I enjoyed that.
Thanks.
Well, I know we don't have much time. I was going to mention some Derek Jensen issues. I just saw him on Sunday in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
But I have something a little more interesting that I thought I'd share with you.
What could be more interesting than gossiping about Derek?
I know, no, kidding, I know. I'm kidding. Hard to believe. Are you familiar with the program On the Media? It's an NPR show.
No, don't know that.
It's kind of what you'd expect from NPR, a slightly better. But anyway, they had this piece on it a few weeks ago about some computer virus or worm that was giving the Iranian nuclear reactors a hard time. And they're trying to trace it to a government or entity. And anyway, it was a Vanity Fair piece by Michael Joseph Gross, and they interviewed him. A paragraph jumped out at me, and can I just read it? It's quick.
Sure.
It's a quick response to a question.
Okay.
The interviewer asks, okay, so the next scene, somebody discovers that the worm is invading little gray plastic boxes called programmable logic controllers, or PLCs. This is really scary. And here's the interesting response by Michael Joseph Gross. PLCs make everything happen in industrial society. They open and close all the valves that make our sewage system work. They control the factories that make our cookies that we eat for lunch. They control the turning of the traffic lights from red to yellow to green. So if you found a way to make these things go haywire, you'd set civilization on its ear. I found that kind of interesting.
Hmm.
I'm not a computer hacker, so
so you're not
doesn't
gonna
do me much good. But and then finally, at the end of the piece here, the same fella, Michael Joseph Gross, says, what does he say? The essence of cyber war is that you can never know for sure who shot the gun. You can never know for sure who dropped the bomb. There's no way to look up in the sky and see the marks on the bottom of the plane. There's no way ever to be sure who to blame. Another interesting thing I thought, you know, we don't have to, you know, comment on what to do with this information, but
no.
Just thought I'd put it out there.
Yeah, the vulnerability of everything that's so insanely interlocked. You know, it reminds me of the Y2K at the end of 1999. You know,
all
those predictions. Because they do run everything, like you say, from elevators to anything. I mean, your car, I mean, it's all computer switches and all that, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I think it was interesting. I kind of missed the whole point of this piece, and I'm not sure that that's the part I care about. I just found it interesting that civilization itself was so, industrial civilization was so vulnerable that some computer hackers, some crafty tech people might be able to bring it all down in a couple of mouse clicks. Not that I'm condoning or promoting that sort
of
thing.
Oh, no. No. Yeah.
I'd share that with
you. But then what would happen then if people want to have all this type of existence? That's an interesting question. It really all is. In fact, you know, you hear these different takes on that. One satellite goes down and it cascades, you know, and then all these other things start failing because they are so interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on, and I've been enjoying the show for the last couple months now, and I'll keep tuning in.
Oh, terrific. Appreciate it. Okay.
All right, thanks a lot.
Okay. Well, as I said, I think Philippe Borel will be with Carl and I next week on the 12th.
Great.
Take
we had
care.
A couple of people calling in to say that they really liked hearing the essay, and folks want to know where they can read it. Will it appear online?
Ooh. Well, it's slated for Species Trader number 5, which last fall I said it would be out soon. But, thanks for asking.
Well,
yeah. It's,
all right.
Okay.
Gotta go.
Be well.